Tonight's reading is from the book of Mark. Jesus sat down opposite the treasury and watched the crowd putting money into the treasury. Many rich people put in large sums. A poor widow came and put in two small copper coins, which are worth a penny. Then he called his disciples and said to them, "Truly, I tell you, this poor widow has put in more than all those who are contributing to the treasury. For all of them have contributed out of their abundance, but she, out of her poverty, has put in everything she had, all she had to live on." This is the word of the Lord.
Hello, Church Without Walls. Good to be with you all. I am Bruce Hansen. For those who don't know me, a member here of the church, recently returned from 3 years in Belgium this past summer. I'm not part of the teaching team. That is that wonderful group of people that regularly lead us into the Word each week. But I was asked to come and speak this evening. So I'm happy to do that, and I love this passage. As many that know me know, I can't really resist teaching about Mark. I can't really resist teaching, but especially about Mark. So it was an obvious yes. Just to remind us, let me get the magic beauty bob here. Oh, yeah. To remind us, we are in the second half of the book of Mark. We did the first half in 2013, then we paused for Advent. We're now finishing the book of Mark before Holy Week. And it's also Lent. And it's, I think, wonderful that the second half of the book of Mark coincides with Lent. And I'll expand on that in the course of my talk here. A comment about Lent, just to remind us. Some of us are mindful of the church calendar. Others may not be. Lent begins on what we call Ash Wednesday, which is actually 47 days before Easter. And during that period, we prepare ourselves for Holy Week, when we remember Jesus' trial and passion and death on a cross and then resurrection. And the period is actually meant to symbolize an important biblical number of 40. The 40 days that it rained on the flood when God judged the earth. The 40 years that Israel spent in the wilderness remembering their God, who they turned from. The 40 days Jesus spent in the wilderness before he entered his public ministry, being tempted by Satan. But if you count on the calendar, Ash Wednesday is actually 47 days before Easter. And the reason is, in that period there are seven Sundays. And in the church tradition, Sundays don't count. Because Sunday is Resurrection Day. The early church met on Sundays and not on the Jewish Sabbath because they're celebrating the resurrection. So it's like every Sunday is a little Easter. So we only count the 40 days. That's why some people in their Lenten fasts don't have to keep their fast on Sunday. So some people, especially in the Anglican tradition, if you give up meat, for example, for Lent, you can eat meat on Sundays because that's not part of Lent. It's part of resurrection. It's Easter. But then there's the more strict among us who don't go in for that kind of levity. Because then you just sort of pig out on Sundays and make up for the whole week. And what's the point of that? But the whole point of Lent, whichever way you keep it or whether you keep it or not, is it's a time of testing and preparation. A time to prepare ourselves for the cross. Every year, to remember again the gospel and to prepare our lives to receive the gospel anew. Because we tend to drift. And one of the ways I like to think of Lent is to reflect on why such a drastic remedy was necessary for what ails me. Because if we think about it, an innocent man voluntarily walked into a conspiratorial trap to be illegally detained, tortured for a false confession which he refused to give, and then unjustly executed. And he did that because I needed it. What sort of ailment could I have that requires that kind of solution. And then if you add to that the fact that he wasn't just an innocent man, he was the unique Son of God who came as a man for that very purpose. The most innocent and undeserving of that treatment of any possible imaginable being. And he said that is the only way to help Bruce Hansen. I must be way sicker than I knew. So when we fast in Lent, it's a way to reflect on the depth of my own depravity and how far I drift from loving God with my whole heart, mind, soul, and strength, because I don't. My love is feeble. And if I reflect for a minute on that, I realize, boy, I need salvation. And the second half of Mark, I think, beautifully addresses this Lenten discipline, because if you've read Mark at all, it changes tone significantly in the middle of chapter 8. Mark has 16 chapters right in the middle of the book. It shifts. And the rest of the book focuses predominantly on Jesus' impending death. He's heading to Jerusalem from chapter 8 on. He's heading to his death. He begins to tell his disciples about his death and what it means, and what it means for them. And they're following him along the way, and they're not getting it, and he's trying to drill into them what his death means for him and for them. And one thing that it means is that his death implies theirs. And that's really slow to dawn on them. That somehow in his dying for us, he's showing us the cure, he's becoming the cure, and he's saying, you have to take the cure. And in some sense, die with me. I think of the analogy of people that have leukemia, cancer of the bone marrow. Terrible cancer. And the way they treat people for it is they have to kill your marrow because your marrow is producing the disease. So they irradiate you or give you chemicals that kill the bone marrow. Well, that kills off the disease, but it also kills off your bone marrow, which produces white blood cells, among other things, which means you can't fight disease. So it's a drastic intervention that sometimes the patient doesn't survive because they get an infection and they can't fight it off. So they put them in these sterile rooms and everyone gowns up and puts on masks when they go in there. And hopefully, when you get a marrow transplant from a matching donor, you grow new marrow that doesn't have the cancer in it. So in a sense, the patient goes through a death and a rebirth to cure that disease. I think Jesus' invitation to come die with him is an invitation to life. Indeed, but it's an invitation to life via a kind of death. Maybe a less biological example is, if you ever had problems with your computer and you call tech support or you get your favorite geek to come help you and they say, you know, we have to just wipe it clean and reinstall the OS. You know, that's a kind of death, right? They have to reinstall everything and... You know, even back in the old days, with MS-DOS, you know, you boot up your computer and say BIOS, you know, loading. Now that stands for something input-output system, so it doesn't actually stand for BIOS as in biology. But I like to think of it that way, because the BIOS was the layer of the operating system even before the operating system. It, like, enabled the operating system to communicate with the hardware. It was firmware, as they called it at that time. And, you know, sometimes your problem can be so bad they have to do a firmware upgrade, which means they have to actually hook it up to another computer and give it a blast that reprograms the chip with the firmware on it. That's like getting new life and resurrecting the computer. The computer dies and comes back again. It gets a new BIOS. One of my best friends in life, a guy named Joe Baldwin that some of you have met, he comes around once in a while. We became friends in fifth grade through a summer swimming program. And we're very close friends to this day. He was never a Christian, came with me to youth group sometimes, and we stayed close all through our college years, even though we're on opposite coasts, and stayed close as we got married and had kids. And he was a lifelong atheist, respected me, but never went in for the Christian thing at all. I prayed for him regularly, and wasn't until 1999 or so. So we were pushing 40, and he's raised kids and had a career and been successful, still a devout atheist, and God started calling his number in a variety of ways. It's a beautiful story. I won't get into now. But he ended up becoming a Christian, and he's a deep, dear brother today. But I had a lot of years with him as this atheist dear friend from childhood. But I remember, he was on the East Coast, I was on the West Coast. During this period, we talked on the phone a lot. He had lots of questions. He had a lot of crises in his life. He was asking all kinds of questions about God. I could tell he was just opening up to the gospel in profound ways. We had these wonderful talks on the phone. I remember one day, he calls me up and he says, "Bruce, I just feel like God's calling me to die and like lose everything." And, you know, me and my pastoral sensitivity, I said, "Well, Joe, it's not, I mean, yeah, sure, it feels like that, but, you know, God loves you. He created you. He's not going to wipe you out. I mean, he redeems what he created. It'll involve some repentance and all that, but you'll still be the Joe I know and love. You'll still be the same person. You'll probably still love flying. He loves flying planes and it's into aviation. You know, he redeems you, but you're going to be the same person. It's not like he just wipes you out and all that." And so here I am trying to give him a little bit of a theological, broader perspective. And he says, "No, Bruce, it's not like that. God's just telling me to die." I was wrong. He was right. I was telling him a post-Easter gospel, and he was in Lent. He needed the Lent gospel, because that's what God was telling him. He had to die. Now, here's still Joe. He is still my dear, dear friend. We share all those memories together. We share life together. We know all we've been through together. He still loves flying, but he had to die. And he had to get a bios rewrite. He had to get a bone marrow transplant. And God transformed him deeply. I mean, it's a beautiful thing to see what's changed in his life. With this passage in Mark, we're in the second half of Mark. We're in the Lenten half of Mark that's all about dying. Like I said, starting in chapter 8, Jesus has been heading towards Jerusalem and talking about the cross and what it means for the disciples, what this journey means. It's a Lenten journey. And in Mark 11, before this chapter, Mark 11, they finally arrive in Jerusalem, their destination where he says he's going to die. They get to the big city, the holy city, the city that has the temple, the great city of our God. And in that city, as soon as he arrives, he begins encountering people who are against him, mainly the religious and political leaders. He has disputes and conflicts with them in public. He seems to seek it out. And it's a really tense, tumultuous time, and you can see the tension rising that's going to lead to their arresting him. And then in Mark 12, where we are today, there's this remarkable little scene. Right at the end of the chapter, after two chapters of all these stories of conflict and debate and dispute and controversy, opposition and power, there's this little scene with this poor widow. And Jesus gets out his holy highlighter and makes a big mark all over this scene. It's his positive counterexample to everyone else he's encountered in Jerusalem to this point. Here in Jerusalem, he finally finds a worshiper, and he makes a point of it. No problem. There's two devices up here. So they're in the temple when this happens. And we know from ancient sources where they were. Inside that first inner courtyard, there's two inner courtyards. The back one holds the Holy of Holies, that tall building. The front one is what they would call the Court of the Women. That was not its official name, but that's what people called it, because in that big outer area all around the outside, anyone could go, Gentiles included. That's the area that Michael talked about in his talk a few weeks ago about the selling of animals out. That was outside in the Court of the Gentiles. In the Court of the Women, as they called it, it wasn't for women. It's the court that all Jewish people could go, including women. And the reason people referred to it as the Court of the Women, because into that next court where the Holy of Holies is, only Jewish men could go, but all Jewish men and women could be in the outer court. And in that outer court, where the both Jewish men and women could be, they had 12 collection jars. And we know this from ancient sources, from rabbinic writings, as well as from Josephus, who was an ancient Jewish historian who lived at the time the temple was standing and actually escaped in 70 AD when the temple was destroyed. So he'd seen it and wrote all about it when he spent the rest of his life in Rome writing the histories of the Jews. We have a lot of vivid descriptions. There were 12 decorated, beautiful jars that were specifically for gifts for the upkeep and functioning of the temple itself. Two of them were specified for collecting the annual temple tax. So all Jewish men, whether living in Israel or living in the diaspora all around the Mediterranean world, all Jewish men were required to contribute a half shekel per year temple tax. So two of those jars were for the temple tax. The other 10 were just for free will offerings to pay for and subsidize the animals, the grain offerings, the wine offerings, food for the priests that worked there, cleaning, maintenance, you know, construction. It was for the upkeep and functioning of this huge temple complex. And people would come and put in free will offerings into those other jars as part of their worship in the temple. Now, it's helpful, I think, to know for this story that the half shekel temple tax that a lot of people are coming to pay, a half shekel equaled 2 Roman denarii. The denarius was the standard pay for a laborer's day's work. And it wasn't an 8-hour day, it was more like a 10 or 12-hour day. Laborers had no rights, they worked really hard, and they were paid really lousy. So a denarius, which is a laborer's day's wage, wasn't really a livable wage. It was probably just enough to buy enough calories to replace what he spent that day working. And laborers lived on the ragged fringe of malnourishment and survival. So the half shekel temple tax was 2 denarii, 2 laborers day's wage. And it says that this woman put in 2 lepta. That's the Greek word. And the lepton was the smallest coin in circulation in the Roman Empire. It was a little tiny copper thing, smaller than our dime. They found lots of them archaeologically. It was worth, get this, 1/128 of a denarius. Nothing. So if a day laborer worked 12 hours in a day, 1/128 of that would be 5.5 minutes per lepton. She put in 2 lepta. She put in the equivalent of 11 minutes of a day laborer's wage. That's all she had. And Jesus makes a big point about this. He makes it in a couple ways. First, it says he calls them together. So in the middle of this busy temple, activity everywhere, people putting things into the offering baskets, it's a crowded area. It's getting close to Holy Week, so it's a time that lots of visitors and pilgrims would come to the temple, so it's a big time. And in the middle of the crowd, he calls for a huddle. Come here, guys, finds a quiet corner and pulls them together because he has to make a point. There are 8 times in Mark, including this one, 7 other times in Mark where it says he called them together to make a point. And each time it's like some serious teaching. And then he says, after he gets them together, truly I say to you, he actually means this, amen. Amen, I say to you, which he does 13 times in Mark. And again, each time is to reinforce a key point he wants them to remember. So he does it double. Okay, pull them together. Amen, I say to you. So this is a big deal he's making. 2 interesting examples of this. Back in Mark 8, where kind of the focus turns the shift towards the cross and the journey to Jerusalem, it says in verse 34, 8:34, he says, he called the crowd to him along with his disciples and said, so call them together, whoever wants to be my disciple must deny themselves and take up their cross and follow me. Whoever wants to save their life will lose it. But whoever loses their life for me and the gospel will save it. This is the kind of thing he summons them together to say. Or the truly I say, an example is Mark 10:28. You know, after Jesus sends the rich guy away because he had too much money, Peter says, kind of defensively, well, look, we left everything and followed you. And Jesus says, you know, calm down. Truly, I tell you, there's no one who's left house or brothers or sisters or mother or father or children or fields for my sake and for the gospel who will not receive 100-fold now in this age. And he lists it out. So these are the kind of things he says when he calls them together and says, truly, I say to you. And what's his point? His big point is that she gave her whole life. Now, it's interesting. It's another way he emphasizes this. He says it 2 times. He says she gave everything she had. He could have stopped there. This woman, they gave out of their abundance. She gave everything she had. But he duplicates it to really reinforce the point. Her whole life. And in that place, in Greek, it actually says bios. A lot of translations say her whole living. They make it some sort of, you know, metaphorical meaning. All she had to live on. But Jesus, I think, is really using this term intentionally, given the context of Mark, where he's talked so much about dying and giving up everything to follow him. He says, she gave everything her had. She had even her whole bios. She's a model disciple. She's embodying those things he said earlier in the second half of Mark about following him. Those things he said about taking up your own cross. The things he said about giving up everything. He's talked about discipleship. They're not getting it. And here he finds a model disciple. And he says, come around, guys. This is what I've been trying to tell you. She had two coins. She could have given one. That would have been ridiculously sacrificial given how poor she is. It would have been understandable if she gave neither. Jesus says she gave it all. That's what I want you guys to see. Just above in the same chapter, Jesus had been debating with a scribe about what it takes to fulfill the law. And Jesus had told them, love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, with all your mind, with all your strength. And the second is like it. Love your neighbor as yourself. Again, she's a model. She's loving God with her whole being. Epitomized in her money. Now, obviously, giving our whole life to God in worship and in love and in service involves a lot more than our money. But our money is often, I think, the best index of where our heart is. Jesus in Luke, in another gospel, says, where your treasure is, there your heart will be also. I always want to change that. Where your heart is, there your money will follow. Jesus says, no, where your heart is, where your money is, there your heart will be. Our money is powerful, and it does direct our affections. See, that's kind of how we like to think of it. But no, the billfold has to get wet. So, does our worship follow our money, or our money our worship? Well, I won't pontificate on that, but they have to, we know, in the end, go together. They have to be aligned, and according to Jesus, we can even lead with our money. We can help our hearts. Love the Lord your God with all your heart, all your soul, all your mind, and all your strength, and all your money. I think it's significant that this whole scene about giving your life so that you might live, about dying with Christ so that you can receive new life, this whole example focuses on money, and it focuses on money in the temple, the place of worship. The place where they gather to worship together. She's a worshiper as well as a disciple. And giving our money is part of our worship. Just like loving God with my whole body, Monday through Friday, is part of my worship. Loving God with all my heart, mind, soul, and strength is worship. And when we restrict worship to only what happens in here, we're truncating what worship really is. And according to this passage, giving belongs in the temple. It's part of worship. Some of you might know, I'm ordained, but not here. I'm ordained in our old church in San Francisco, which is an African-American church. And part of the tradition of the church where I was ordained, that I love, is that the giving of our tithes and offerings happens during the worship service. And not only that, we march. So like we do here for communion, we put the baskets up front, and starting in the back, we stand up, the choir sings, oh, we don't have that either. The band is playing, everyone from the back pew, starting in the back pew, marches around, and they put it in the offering baskets in the front, and everyone's talking. So some people are singing along with the music. Some people are stopping and shaking hands with friends. It's a celebratory moment. It's joyful. And we march around and put on our tithes and offerings. And even if you have nothing to give, you still march around because it's social and it's fun and it's a long service. And it's when you kind of get to get up and stretch your legs. I love that part of our service. I really do. Our giving is part of our worship. And come on down, Ron. So tonight, we're going to move our offering box into here, for my sake. Make me feel at home. Thank you. Because, you know, I just don't like it that our offering box is out on a table in the foyer, and it's not even obvious. When we first moved back from Belgium this summer, I wanted to start giving to support Church Without Walls. It took me 3 weeks to find that. I kept looking and looking, thinking it has to be here somewhere. I finally had to ask. It's all the way out by the door, you know, even before the greeters. So tonight it's here. I'll say something about it in a minute, because I know most of you didn't come prepared to give, or that you pledge and you give at the beginning of the month or whatever, but I still have something we can do with this. I just want to add, while I'm on a pet topic, worship is what we do with our money. Worship is how we live. Worship is loving God and loving our neighbor. So I really don't like it when we refer to the singing part of our service as worship. Sure, it's part of worship. But we often say, who's leading worship tonight? As if the announcements aren't part of worship. Well, when someone says, who's leading worship tonight? I say, well, Tim, like he always does. Because the announcements are part of worship. Right? If the announcements don't have to do with loving God with our heart, mind, soul, and strength, then we shouldn't have them here. But if they are part of us together as a community, loving God with our heart, mind, soul, and strength, then that's worship. So if you want to talk about the musical part as worship, at least call it musical worship. Otherwise, we just reproduce this terrible theology.
That's right.
So
that's right.
I know he's with me.
That's right.
Thank you, Michael. Now, this is a big encouragement. Our church is a generous church. Okay, we give a lot of money away. I know that from people I've talked to. I know it from a lot of people I know that are missions that are funded by this church. We give money to a lot of excellent nonprofits and non-governmental organizations and missionaries and ministry. We have people funding wells in the developing world where they need fresh water for health and productivity. We have people that give to Young Life, caring for young people at our Berkeley Public Schools. We have people here funding someone teaching English in China and serving Iranian immigrants in Turkey, and campus ministry with InterVarsity, and the functioning of CWOW itself. In fact, I'd go so far as to say that I'm pretty confident this church gives away a lot more money outside of CWOW's functions than we give to CWOW. And I think that's a beautiful thing. And I hope that continues, because even at CWOW, we're a church that gives ourselves away. That is wonderful. I would love someday to actually do an anonymous poll where we actually find out how much money is going out from this church. I think it would be a wonderful cause of celebration. But I also want to remind us that that is all worship. Mm-hmm. And part of our worship is also funding Church Without Walls, which a lot of us do here generously. But I want to reinforce that tonight, because that's part of the task of this sermon, and it fits with the passage. All those offering jars in the temple were for the functioning of the temple. The center of collective worship and identity and reinforcing who they are before their God as they go out and be Israel and God's people wherever they live, in Jerusalem, in Israel, or in the diaspora. So I want to remind us that when we give to this box, we're funding the work that we do, the pastor we have now and the new pastor we are searching for, our programs that we put on, this great Holy Week extravaganza we do every year, the rent on this facility and fixing things we break here and looking for a bigger one. You know, we would like to actually hire a full-time pastor and get a bigger facility, right? So when we give to that, that's worship, because Jesus in this passage has praised a woman doing that kind of worship. So I want to remind us of that and ask that one of our next steps, one of our actions in response to this word, is to reflect in Lent on my giving, on whether I am giving my whole life to God in with how my money goes. If I analyze my money, what does it say about my heart? And that I want to reflect on my giving to Church Without Walls, the support of this community that we together form, a budget that we together make and vote on, programs that we together execute. So I invite you to reflect on your giving to CWOW and consider that part of your worship. And here comes the little box up here. It's there, so tonight when we come up for communion, you'll walk right past it. Now, I realize most people here pledge. We like that because it helps us budget. So I'm all for that. And a lot of us who pledge give monthly, so you probably gave already at the beginning of the month. You weren't planning to give tonight. That's fine. And whatever people give tonight on spontaneously, it's not going to make a big difference in the Church Without Walls budget overall. We're not talking about fixing the budget. We're actually doing okay right now, as those of you at our last church meeting know. But if God is speaking to you about reevaluating your giving in Lent, if part of your Lenten discipline is reflecting on what your money says about your heart and what it means to love God with all your heart, mind, soul, and money, with your money, if that's where you're at tonight, I invite you to make a token gesture of worship. Something you have. I don't know what it is in your wallet, but come by and put something in there for you as an act of worship to say, yes, God, I am worshiping you with my money, and this is my statement that this Lent, I want to reflect and reevaluate my life on that front. So I'm inviting you to do that as a token of your commitment to God and response to this. That's why this will be up here when you come by for communion. Lastly, if you want to respond on the connection card, you can say that this Lent, you ought to love God by worshiping Him with your whole life. And you know where that journey needs to take you, towards the cross. Or that you feel called to turn from self-preservation. That's often what restricts us from serving and giving, whether it's money or time. Because going to the cross is kind of the opposite of self-preservation. Giving away helps us with that. That also ties into Michael's sermon a few weeks ago. And lastly, what I was just referring to, that maybe God is speaking to you this Lent to respond by regular financial giving towards the budget of Church Without Walls. And if God speaks to you in that way, I do encourage you to make a pledge and tell Lynn Lee so that we actually know what our budget is.